Welcome to In the Line of Fire. I'm your host, Gary Dillon. This podcast will share insights into the lives of public safety professionals who play a crucial role in society, often putting their own lives on the line to ensure the safety and well-being of their communities. Throughout the series, I'm sure you'll discover unique stories and motivations from each guest who bring their perspective and experiences to showcase the various reasons why they commit their lives to protecting others. I look forward to hearing these inspiring stories and learning more about the incredible work these individuals do. In the last episode of the disappearance of Elsie Mae Roan, retired West Point Police Chief Bobby Moyer and an FBI agent interviewed a suspect in Elsie's disappearance. Bobby was later contacted about the suspect's potential link to the Colonial Parkway murders. We're back here in the Versa Studios doing episode 3 of In the Line of Fire with Gary Dillon, and I have retired Police Chief Bobby Moyer with me, and we're discussing the missing persons case of Elsie Mae Roan, who disappeared from West Point, Virginia on May 20th, 1957, without a trace. Bobby, welcome back.
Thanks, Gary. Again, thanks to you and for Versa for helping to bring this to light. Appreciate all of your interest and all of your efforts. Thank
Glad
you.
Glad to do it.
All righty. Well, I guess we kind of left off last time with the conversation that Liza and I had, wherein she found Lloyd's name as a possible suspect in the Colonial Parkway murders. And that was back in the 86, 87, 88, and 89.
That was probably pretty shocking when she called you with that information.
I was
because that was floored. That was big, and they were still talking about that today. I mean, yeah. You can see articles and things mm-hmm. on that investigation, the Colonial Parkway murders.
Unsolved as well. So, I think that that aspect is what brought Liza and I together, she's searching for that as well as I, and then, she helping and searching to try to find Elsie Mae too. But it was, I don't know where it'd be without her. It's been a real true team effort. But
what's Liza's background with the FBI? What some of the things that she does?
Does
she do criminal profiling?
Not about profiles, but an investigator. She's a polygrapher. Got a background, Army, medical field as well. She's a sharp cookie. But so she said, your guys come up in this parkway. It's like, what are you talking about here? She said, I've got this paper in here, and it's a complaint request incident report from old Virginia State Police records. And it was a complaint, or just noted that, dated November the 27th, 1989. And it comes from a Hank Mundy. Hank has passed away, but he retired, former state police investigator. When he retired from state police, he went on and became the chief of police in Suffolk, and he retired from there as well. But in this document, he states, and this is, again, regards to Colonial Parkway murders along I-64, reminded him of an applicant he investigated by the name of X, who was from West Point and worked for the Hampton Police Department at the time. According to X, he wanted to be a trooper more than anything else in the world. However, when Mr. Mundy asked him to take a polygraph concerning the disappearance of a young girl from West Point, who was pregnant. All right.
Okay.
Catch that?
Yeah.
All right. He refused. The girl had gone to Richmond with him and was never seen again. Mr. Mundy felt very strongly that X had knowledge of her disappearance but was not able to prove it. Mr. Mundy wanted this information passed on to investigating members for whatever it might be worth. Henry Hank Mundy did the investigation. He filed this with the investigators on the Colonial Parkway, November of 89, and before the investigators could get back with him to clarify or follow up, he had a massive heart attack in January of 90 and passed away. So we talk about another door being closed.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you think about it, this is the first occasion that said who was pregnant. You know, said where she, Elsie Mae, was pregnant. And you reflect back on, if you mentioned, remember from the last episode, I mentioned that, you know, her grades had kind of gone down a little bit in that last term. You know, apparently, you know, it had a lot weighing on her mind. And so this could have very well been, certainly I think would be the just cause for a 16-year-old to be fretting about life and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
But so it's like, wow, this document here provided a wealth of knowledge. And again, this was one of those where, you know, one door closes and you know, the door closed with Mundy passing away, but the doors that opened on this, one, he was associated with the potential, you know, Parkway killings. You know, he worked for the Hampton Police Department at the time. This hadn't come up before either.
Yeah. So Lloyd left West Point and went on to be a police officer.
Well, he left West Point, went into the military, was in, came back, and it looks like you know, became an officer. Although I think there were a couple other things that he did before this.
Do you know anything about his service with the police department and how he did it, how long he was there, how well he did?
Well, that's
any
funny.
Issues?
Funny you should ask.
You're very thorough, Bobby. Very thorough.
I, of course, contacted, you know, Hampton PD and personnel and tried to, you know, ascertain any records or whatever they had. And I had somebody that was really, really helpful, you know, working on that, helping out to dig, that was familiar with their processes and system. And came up with a little card. And in speaking with some of the old timers, they indicated that, well, if you had this type of card with this particular information on it, you had an internal affairs investigation done on you. Of course, nothing existed at this point, you know, it's being, you know, 50 years later. All those records were long gone. But in talking with a couple of the other old timers, allegedly, again, you know, nothing but hearsay, the accusations were such that Lloyd would go downtown on his beat, turn his jacket inside out, and leave his cap in the taxi stand, and commence to spending time with some of the ladies of the evening.
Huh.
So, again, that's what the that indicated, but there's interesting details on some of those things as well. But he had, you know, backing up with Lloyd though, as far as the jobs he had a license to sell life insurance, and it was revoked because he was keeping the premiums and had a deficiency in his account. That was in 67. In 72, a letter from attorney in the state of Colorado regarding alimony issues. You know, in August of 84, he was investigated at Fort Monroe for, you know, stealing equipment or as a contractor. You know, so just, you know, prior to that, he took, let's see, this was in 66, he took out a loan in his first wife's name by forging her name on it. So, you know, I mean, a liar, a cheat, a loner. Yeah, I mean, this... I don't have to make that up. You know, this is proof. This is evidence, you know, of that. But the Hampton connection there was very helpful too. So went down that route. And his other wives were first wife, second wife were who and third wife, you know, we spoke with, were able to confirm, you know, a lot of these things that we were finding. So on subsequent interviews. One other issue, when you'd get Lloyd in conversation, you'd want to you know, get him in a spot, you know, he was trying to get out of. He would, very dramatic, but would go, oh, you know, and he'd grab his back. You go, oh my gosh, you okay? Yeah. I'm fine. Just a old injury. I said, gosh, how did that happen? Well, you know, again, very dramatic. Yeah, it's when I was in Germany. There we were, about 5,000 feet. Engine went out. It wasn't looking good. I mean, playing this stuff up.
Yeah, he's watching too many of those movies.
The
right-hand cabinet.
Exactly. That's exactly, and that's what I mentioned earlier. That's what it would come back. He based a lot of his stories on the things he learned from watching these movies. Because he said, yeah, he had to bail out of the airplane. Yeah, hurt my back. Gosh, you know, I'm sorry, Lord. Thank you for your service to our country. You know, yeah. and that was on one interview. Subsequent interview, and we're able to actually chat with some of the guys that he was in service with.
Oh boy, this ought to be good.
And so you get back with him. Oh, I'll say, well. You know, Lloyd, does John Doe ring a bell for you? Name? He kind of looked puzzled at you. You know, well, what about Jimmy Johnson? Billy Smith? I'll throw these things. Well, I said, well, these were all guys that you were in your unit when you were in Germany. And you know what? And not that there's anything wrong with this, mind you. It all takes everybody's service. You know, he was a clerk. All right, and again, nothing at all wrong with that, but he wanted everybody to believe he was jumping out of airplanes, and that's how he hurt his back. So when we called him, I said, well, we've talked to Johnny and Billy and John here, and they say that, you were on a desk. You never even saw the inside of a plane except getting there and coming home. Well, I guess you know more about me than I do, is what he'd say.
Oh, man.
Say, well, some things, yeah, I do. But again, it comes back to the point of how much of this fictitious storytelling did actually became in his mind a reality over the years.
Yeah, you tell it so much, you end up believing it. Or if
you've
repeated it so much, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even later, he had a flight suit. Hanging in his hallway, with his name on it, and a helmet a flight helmet that had his name on it, and that's a sign right there. The pilots they have their call sign; they don't have their name on it. But he had told his one of his neighbors that he flew helicopters in Vietnam, and
picked that up at the military surplus
Army
store,
surplus
right?
store, yeah. And painted up, but it was just his whole life was like that, of trying to I don't know, make himself, bigger, larger than life, but using these movies to help to write those lies, kind of unfortunate. And, part of me, I felt sad for him. I really did. I felt bad for him because he had no relationship. And that's what we told him at one point. Said, you every relationship you've had in your life has been tainted because of what happened in West Point. And I told him in one subsequent interview too that and it was after his third wife passed away. Dorothy, nice lady, really nice lady. I'm glad I got a chance to meet her. And you get him in a jam or get him in a spot, and he'd look over at her picture on the wall. And I said, I know you miss her, Lloyd. I know you miss her. She was a real nice lady. I know you take some comfort in knowing that, you all had a lot of good years together. I said, but you know what? I said, she's in a place right now where she knows what happened. I said, is she looking down or is she proud of you right now for the way you're acting, for the way you're talking, for the things you're hiding? Is she proud of you? And you could just see his head sink. So, again, he knew more, obviously than he was letting on. But, we went back down on numerous occasions. I spent hours around his kitchen table. Liza and I both, and then in subsequent interviews, went down with trying to find a maybe he didn't like me, so I tried to find somebody to take, you know, with me to maybe see if the combination, you know, would be a little different. And of course, more on that, you know, later. But I just never had the right combination, I guess.
When you're meeting with this guy, did you just let him beat his chest and, you know, have his bravado moments there every so often during the conversations? Oh, yeah. And then get back to the business?
Yeah.
His stories about how great he is and then just kind of bring him back down. Okay, mm-hmm. Now we have more questions about
him. Yeah. Well, Kelsey I told May. Him this, that, and other. And, you know, I said, yeah. And again, coming to the door every time with a pistol in his hand. And it was actually to the point where it was one of the neighbors mentioned that she went to check on him one day. Of course, he came to the door with the you know, the gun in his hand.
So that was common. It wasn't just of you all. It was us. Anybody.
It was everybody. But she said she saw the red dot cross, you know, in front of, on her chest there, and said blessed him up one side and down the other. And rightly so, you know. But he was scared of something.
Yeah, what was he waiting on? Who was he waiting on?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, man, on that. But it's, you know, like I say, he was at Hampton. You know, no records, like I say, were available on the IA that was done. Yeah,
but how long was he in Hampton? I don't know if we covered that before.
65, 66, somewhere right around there. Wasn't very long.
So just a couple of years.
Yeah.
The PD.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I know what I was thinking a moment ago when you were talking about going to his door and him showing up with a pistol each time. And, you know, for somebody like me or anybody else that's worked in law enforcement or just the general public, you're going to be put off by that. Whoa, whoa, whoa. But mm-hmm. You being a retired game warden, that's just a day in the life of a game warden, because when you go out into the woods, everybody's got a gun, right?
That's true.
It probably didn't startle you at all.
Well,
a fishing pole.
I was, yeah. I was certainly aware of it, that's for sure. But I think he was looking for that reaction, though. He was looking for some type of, oh, my gosh, you know. And when we didn't feed into that, it took the opportunity for his bravado down a notch.
Yeah, he wanted to establish some dominance, mm-hmm. or have that bravado moment there, mm-hmm. to just really feel good about himself.
But yeah, but he was something else. He was something else. You know, and in subsequent days there, you know, we talked with the first wife, you know, who I mentioned previously. You know, kind of gave you little brief on the second wife and of course the third one, you know, and how the connection was early on. It was the fact that he, you know, did not really know how to make an honest day's work, you know, with the loan, with the contractor. And, you know, one of the wives said that if he made any money, he would spend it as quick as he got it. And she was actually having to pay some of the employees out of her account just to keep it from going any further. I don't even know. I'd have to go back and count, but it was numerous interviews with him. But interesting to see the wives. And, you know, you got, I guess, I don't know what your ex-wife would say about you, but you're a good guy.
My ex-wife loves me. I've got the best ex-wife ever.
How can you not, man? You're a lovable guy. But, you know, when one ex is saying the same thing that number two ex is saying, you know, you got to kind of lend a little credibility,
yeah.
You know, to that. So,
and number three probably isn't in a position where she can talk yet because she's still with him.
And she's still with him, yeah.
So, what's next, Bobby? So, you've got this series of interviews. Any other suspects established throughout this investigation?
Well, yeah.
So, Bobby, you've had these interviews, several interviews, and I know you'll talk about them more later, these interviews with Lloyd, mm-hmm. these trips to North Carolina you've made with various people to conduct those interviews. What I keep coming back to is that article that I first read opening into the last episode, mm-hmm. a newspaper article that first came out when Elsie May went missing. It was, about 3 days before she was actually reported missing?
Yeah.
And we mentioned that, you know, her adoptive father worked at the Cheatham Annex, which is near Williamsburg, mm-hmm. Worked night shift there. But I keep thinking about that. That's a long time before you report your young daughter missing.
Yeah, that does.
Any more to that into her home life that would shed some light on why it took so long? Or
yeah, I think at that time, I think she had a pretty rough home life in the fact that, you know, one, the father Harry never was very doting or caring. You know, it was said that Alfredo was the one that made for the child's well-being and took care of her and all that. So once Alfredo passed away, again, that's 55, there was a lot of tension between her and her father, her and Harry. You know, I guess it wasn't as much as it could be since he was working at night and she was, you know, sleeping at night. He was sleeping during the day. She was at school during the day. So their paths did not cross in a loving way very often. And I think the fact that, you know, it was 3 days before he reported her missing is certainly, you know, testament to that fact. But after Alfredo passed, you know, Harry became involved, romantically involved with another woman. Ended up, you'll love this one too. They were going to get married, but they didn't tell Elsie May. She found out about it, allegedly, when she came from school one day and the preacher was there performing the service. So
right there in the house.
Right there in the house. So, you know, what does that tell you there as well? So, and I think once they were married, the new wife, Edna, she was trying to get Elsie May settled back in a little bit. I think she did, since, you know, Harry was there and sleeping during the day, Elsie May just kind of did what she wanted to. And however that ended up working out, it was Edna, I think, was trying to rein her back in a little bit.
What was your opinion of Edna just from the interviews and the information you have? Or was she a good person, you think, trying to do the right thing?
From what I gather, she had good intentions, but from what I understand, she was very aloof, you know, not really paying attention or not really aware of reality, you know, of what was going on. So I think that in itself may have clouded her perception of the relationship between Harry and Elsie May. But
do you know anything about the house that they lived in that was torn down in the late 90s? You know, did Elsie May have her own room? You know, I'm curious about the layout of that house.
She had her own a room, yes. I couldn't find anything through the historical records. I talked with a longtime historian there, Reverend Bill, and he does a lot with the
Reverend Bill's. I meant to tell you, he reached out to me. Did he? Through LinkedIn. Yeah, he's very excited about this. The series we're doing.
Oh, wow.
He's following it closely.
He's a fine gentleman. And as you know, in later years was our chaplain, mm-hmm. you know, at the police department, and just an outstanding man. It's a real, real privilege and pleasure just to know him. Saw him recently at the National Night Out, had a chance to chat a little bit, but he hadn't changed a bit. But anyway, went through and Bill says they can't find any photos. He said, and that's just kind of odd too, because we have photos of houses, mm-hmm. but nothing existed here. He could give me a picture of the one next to it that was torn down, which is where Lloyd and Elsie May allegedly did their homework together. So the neighbor, you know, could kind of keep an eye on the front porch there, mm-hmm. sitting out there. But I did, it's funny, again, the connections and how things happen. But when I went downtown to go to town hall, I'd always park around back, you know, and leave the spaces up front, you know, open for the town folk and the community, people coming in to do business. And one particular day I was downtown and I was I just got to run in real quick. I'll just pull up out front here, run in, drop off, you know, whatever it was, come back out. When I pulled up, I saw a house across the street from town hall. You'll remember Charlotte. Mm-hmm. It was the
work for the town,
town receptionist for years. She and her husband and her sister lived there in the house across from town hall. I always thought it was kind of neat. I used to walk across the street and you're at work, but but a really, really sweet lady. And for some reason, they were sitting out on the front porch. All right. One, I never parked up front. Two, even in driving by, I don't ever recall seeing them sitting on the front porch. So I got out of the car and I saw him sitting over, and I went over. Hey, you know, how y'all doing? Blah blah blah. And I think at that point Charlotte had retired. I said, Charlotte, you've been around here a long time. And she said, well, not long as Hugh, and her husband. I said, yeah. I said he grew up and pointed to that house across the street. That was his, you know, this was his grandparents' house. He grew up there. Blah blah blah. And I said, you remember the house that was over here that they tore down then for to build the, you know, town hall? And he goes, yeah, the Roan house. I was like, yes, the Roan house. Exactly. So, and Charlotte had a friend that had lived over that one time too. So I asked him, I said, can you guys describe that for me? And they would say, oh, you come up the stoop, you goes along, you know, hallway to the back steps, you know, kind of up and around. It had three bedrooms up the top of the stairs, kitchen in the back, blah, blah, blah. You went on to describe the house in some, you know, some fashion. And I said, well, that's great information. And I actually sketched it out, you know, made a sketch of it so I could look back at it. And he said, in fact, he said, Elsie May used to babysit me. I'm like, what? How does this all come together? You know, he said, well, tell me about her. Says, oh, she was sweet. Said she'd come over and, or I'd go over there and we'd make sandwiches and go off on a picnic, you know, during the day. Said he was about, I think, 6 or 7 at the time, but, you know, recalled her being there. And I said, well, what do you recall anything? I mean, I know you were a kid then. Do you recall anything being said, you know, when she disappeared? And he goes, no, he said, I was a little young for that. And talking with a couple of the classmates in and around that time, they were younger as well. Well, you know, sophomores in high school. Said, and one of them's mother always said, don't you go down there and play in that swamp. You might run into Elsie May. I was like, wow.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And it's like, did she know something, or is she just trying to keep Susie, you know, from getting her clothes messed up in all that swamp water and mud? But, you know, throw it up for, you know, for that. Just very, very interesting there. But, you know, Edna, you know, back to the home life there, Edna actually had three daughters, you know, obviously from a previous marriage. They lived all in, you know, in around town too. So that was kind of interesting there.
So Bobby, referring back to this original article you handed to me in the last episode, you know, I mentioned before that the police weren't alerted right away when Elsie May disappeared. And another thing that jumped out at me was, you know, police said that it appeared that she left with packed bags, unable to determine how she left or where she went. But she was last seen, one of the last people to see her, was an officer, a West Point Town police officer by the name of Billy Hagler. And he reported seeing her the night she disappeared with two suitcases on the street just before 11 p.m. You know, the West Point Police Department stopped operations in 1976, and those operations were taken over by the King William County Sheriff's Office. So any records that would have existed from that time likely would have been turned over to the sheriff's office or maybe the Commonwealth attorney, but you haven't been able to find anything. But
no.
Do you know anything about this Hagler officer? Is there any more information other than what is in this article about Billy Hagler?
That's another interesting observation there, Gary. After one of our interviews with Lloyd coming back up the road, you know, all of the information that I've got is really following up on things that were done 60 years ago now, you know, 1957. So I got to get to thinking about, you know, if I'm going down the same path that they did back then, why would I expect any different results? It's like, oh man. Well, let's back up and look at this. Hagler, Billy Hagler. All right. A town officer sees this little 16-year-old girl standing out on the street corner at almost 11 o'clock at night, by his words there, and doesn't follow up on it. Okay, well, let's look at that. Well, let's see what's up with Billy. Billy was from a large family. He was one of six boys and four girls.
Local boy?
Local. Mm-hmm. And grew up kind of, you know, having to, you know, to scrap a little bit for what he got. Records indicate, you know, he and some of his brothers had, you know, part-time jobs to help, you know, the family make ends meet. He grew up kind of rough. All right. He came on with the police department, and not that that's, you know, anything, the rough growing up, not that that's any one major factor, but just the things I offer, look at it in the totality of it all here. All right, as I mentioned earlier, he there was really no training up until 1964. So in 1957, it was like, yeah, you look like a nice guy. Here's a badge and a gun, and go do the right thing. Well, Billy came on 2 or 3 months before Elsie May disappeared. All right.
So, yeah, not a cop very long.
Mm-mm. And he quit about 2 or 3 months after she disappeared.
I'd like to know. I'd like you to share with the listeners how you found this information, because I may have said in the first episode, you know, when Bobby started looking into this, he would tell me little bits and pieces of it, and I found it fascinating. But he always kept me in the loop, and I've accompanied him different things he's done on the case, and one of them was a trip to town hall to mm-hmm. dig into this Officer Hagler a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty interesting what is still out there.
It is, and what's still, you know, available if you just dig in the right places. But this is just a series of you know, things that happened to make you go, yeah, there's higher involvement here. You know, and the people at town at you know, the town of West Point that helped, you know, look through boxes and records and all that, you know, really, you know, appreciate them lending their expertise to
you. Can't beat
out to
the town hall staff in West Point. You talk about some of the most helpful people out there.
Yep.
And I can see Donna and others
yep.
climbing into the cavernous attic at West Point.
Yeah.
And going through records until they find something that's going to help you. As hot yeah. as it is in that attic, probably. Yeah. They, you know,
but you're,
that's
you're
just
right.
how they are. They're good people.
Right. Good people. And I've said it before. I said, you know, anybody wants to complain about working for West Point, hadn't worked anywhere else.
That's the truth.
So, like I say, good bunch of people, good bunch of people. So that was a connection. All right, one, he sees this girl on the street corner, doesn't say anything. Two, he doesn't have much experience and doesn't stick around to get it because he left, you know, just a couple months after Elsie May disappeared. Well, I throw another kicker caveat in it for you. I mentioned that Mr. Roan had gotten remarried, Edna. All right, Edna had three daughters, as I mentioned. One of those daughters, the youngest one, was married. Okay, you know who she was married to?
I didn't know this.
Billy. So, not only
so,
is this...
Okay, let me get this right. So, Elsie May's adopted father, who didn't report her missing for
three days,
mm-hmm. got remarried to someone named Edna,
mm-hmm.
and one of Edna's three daughters was married to Billy Hagler, the last person or one of the last people to see Elsie May
mm-hmm.
on the street with two suitcases mm-hmm. near 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. So not only is this girl, this is his, I'd have to do the map on it or the flow chart, but it's stepsister-in-law, and you don't go, sis, what are you doing? Where are you going?
Yeah.
It sounds a little
it's
fun.
One thing if you're just walking down the street, but
a little odd.
You got suitcases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what'd you find out about the records?
Well,
or am I jumping too far ahead?
No.
Just tell me to slow down.
His records. Billy, like I say, went on to leave town. He left town. In fact, left his wife who was pregnant. All right. So he left his pregnant wife. And sources say that he went to North Carolina, out in the mountain areas of North Carolina. But over the next number of years, he went on to have a pretty healthy criminal record in three different states. Drugs, fighting, impersonating a police officer, you know, some pretty heavy things there. So that you put all that together and you go, well, what was he running from?
Yeah, so he's there as a police officer a couple months before she goes missing, right? Mm-hmm. We've established that. And then she goes missing. When does he leave?
He's there for about 3 months.
Okay, so you're figuring just under 6 months on the job total.
Well, yeah, but and then also you start thinking about it too. Again, just a theory, no accusations, but who better to undermine the course of an investigation than somebody from within?
Yeah. Do we know how many people were employed by the West Point Police Department in 1957?
I think it was like four. You know, it was very, very small.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Do you know where Hagler lived? Did you ever find out where his last address in West Point was before he packed up and headed south?
Yeah, they were up on, he and his wife, I think it was, I've got it in some notes, up on 16th Street, I think it was, one of the houses up there.
Okay, so further up.
Mm-hmm.
Further up.
Yeah.
North of the downtown area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, you look at the totality of it all. You know, can you see Harry as having something to do with it? If you're not going to report her missing for 3 days,
yeah,
maybe so. Can you see, you know, Lloyd having something to do with it? Yeah. Can you see Billy having something to do with it?
Yeah, I mean you have options here.
Yeah. So that document that Liza had that indicated you know, Lloyd had applied to be a state trooper at one time. Well, up until this point, that was new information. But up until this point, I've been running all the databases, everything we could, showing, you know, Elsie May is a victim, you know, Lloyd is a suspect. And nothing was showing up. So when we found out that he'd applied for state police, I contacted Bob again with the cold case unit there, who again was working on Grant, and said, Bob, look at see what you could find on, you know, Lloyd as an applicant for state police. I said, maybe let's check those files. So he said, okay. And a few days later, he called me back and he goes, I think I got something for you. And I was like, oh man, I can't wait. Cause up until then it was just, you know, nothing, really existed. And I said, at least this will give me a good start on what they found out, in that background stage. So, of course talked to Bob and he said, yep, let's meet in the morning. I said, good. I said, I can't wait. I got, you know, we got like Eliza and I were going to go back down and have another interview with Lloyd, you know, within 3 days of you know, this conversation with Bob. And I said, man, whatever's in there was just, you know, need to know, you know, because that could be very relevant in our line of questioning. So I go over and I meet Bob over at SPHQ the next day, bright and early. He said, let's go get us a cup of coffee. I said, all right. Let's go get a cup of coffee. Let me see the folder. I want to see. I can't wait to get in this thing, see what's there. And he says, I can let you look at this, but I can't let you have it. And I said, what do you mean? You can't. I said, this is still an active criminal investigation. What do you mean you can't let me have this? This could be very relevant. Well, you bring state police in on it, and we'll see what we can do. And that's just something about that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah, yeah.
And because I know I didn't care, and still, who does what or who finds whom. It's about her. It's about Elsie May, giving her some final rest. But it kind of ticked me off. So I said, Bob, hold on to that file. I went back down to West Point and wrote a search warrant for those documents, and got it, and came on back up and said, Bob, I said, I'll take those records now. So they're doing the search warrant on state police.
So you got a search warrant and served it on the Virginia State Police.
Yes.
How'd that go?
How's the joke? Not too good. No, I got what I wanted, and I didn't hear anything back. There was I don't even know his name. Not that I would mention it if I could, but there was a lieutenant up there, I think, that had some other ideas with how to handle that. I feel Bob was on my team, you know, with doing what we wanted to do. But then, you know, fast forward a couple of years, I'm back with working with some state police guys now, some analysts and special agent now. And let's put it this way, the relationship is very different. You know, I can't thank these guys enough. And there'll be some more interesting information coming up in another episode on our most recent meeting with the state police and the analysts, and also Tim, you know, the chief at West Point now currently has been very supportive through all this, and it's a true team effort. A lot of people working on this.
So Billy Hagler, the West Point police officer, 6 months on the job before he bails and he goes somewhere else. A couple months before Elsie May goes missing, a couple months after she goes missing, he's now gone. So back to Lloyd, who was your primary suspect, the acquaintance or boyfriend from high school. We know that Lloyd knows Elsie May's adoptive father.
Mm-hmm.
His name?
Harry.
Is Harry.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Harry has a relationship with Officer Hagler because Hagler is married to Harry's new wife's daughter, one of the daughters.
Oh, you're keeping
I'm
up with this
all
good,
this
man.
To Bobby. Man, it's been a while, but I'm tracking all this here. So now so you have three people here: Hagler, Harry, and Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
To complete the triangle, is there any relationship between Lloyd and Officer Hagler? Did they know each other?
Another interesting observation. Yes, they knew each other. Billy was, you know, active in the community when he was an officer. He was in the newspaper for, you know, having taught a, you know, hunter safety class and helping out with the rifle team and doing this, that, and the other. And of course, you know, small community anyway, people know each other pretty well. And they did know each other. Billy was a little bit older, and I think Lloyd was very much intimidated by him for some reason.
Have you been able to figure out why?
Well, something happened. Something happened, and whether it's related to Elsie May's disappearance or not, and I think it is at the mere mention of Billy's name to Lloyd, it just almost again physically shakes. There's something there. He can
so describe that. When did that first happen?
Well, we were looking at the article early on, newspaper article early on, and right out of the gate, in the first interview. You know, here to talk to you about, a girl went missing from the town of West Point. Well, you need to talk to Billy Hagler. It's like, whoa, where did that come from? That was just right out of the gate.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, well, you know, right now we're here to talk to you. And I said, and Billy's passed away. He's gone away from here a long time.
Well, I don't know.
And then you talk with Lloyd a little bit further, particularly when he gets on the bravado,
Right.
You know, a tough guy, the John Wayne, I'll tell you this, you know, Pilgrim, whatever he gets into. You can look at him when he's in that state and just go, Billy Hagler. And it's almost like you just see the wind coming out. You see the cower in him. you know, over the mere mention of the name.
What can you describe the body language that once you mention Billy Hagler's name to Lloyd?
Yeah, voice
what
changes.
What does his body do?
Voice changes. Body slumps. You know, goes from this big bravado to something that indicates he's afraid of something. So what's he afraid of?
And this guy's dead. When did Hagler die?
Right. 86.
Okay, he's been gone for a long time.
Yeah. Well, 80, I think it was 86, yeah.
When you mentioned to Lloyd that Hagler was dead, do you think he was aware?
I think he did. I think he was. I think he was trying to deflect. That was one of those instances. Because I told him, I said, Lloyd, you and I both know, Billy's been dead for years.
But yet the mention of his name still caused this guy to basically lock up or shut down.
Yeah.
Of somebody that's dead and has been dead.
Right. So what's up with that?
Guess we'll talk about that more in the next episode.
Yep, certainly. There's certainly more to come. And but it's all for the sole purpose of finding Elsie May. And if somebody's got an idea out there, email Gary. And we'll go from there. But believe me, we've gone down a lot of paths, but there's one that we haven't gone down, and that's the one that leads to her. So that's the one we're looking for.
Okay. Well, Bobby, thanks again for another really interesting episode into the disappearance of Elsie May. If you have any tips, and a lot of people have reached out to me since we started this podcast, particularly about this series we're doing on Elsie May. I just wanted more information, really wanting to know when the next episode is. You have some followers here, Bobby. But if you have any information or any leads or any direction you think Bobby should take with this, feel free to email me, and I will forward that on to him. And the email address is simple. It's InTheLineOfFirePodcast@gmail.com. InTheLineOfFirePodcast@gmail.com. Or you can post a message on the Facebook page dedicated to the podcast, and I will get that information to Bobby.
Just another thanks again, Gary. Appreciate you and Versa for taking this on. I look forward to sitting down with you again. And of course, if any of our listeners have thoughts or ideas, always open to hearing, well, have you done this or would you do that? Been down a lot of paths, but the only path that we haven't been down is the one that leads us to her. So welcome any comments or any thoughts.
This concludes this episode of In the Line of Fire with Gary Dillon. Thanks to Bobby Moyer for agreeing to talk about the disappearance of Elsie May Roan and his investigative journey to bring closure to this case. In the Line of Fire is sponsored by Versa, Virginia's largest and most financially sound group self-insurance pool, providing auto, property, liability, and workers' compensation coverage to local governments, schools, and authorities.